Today's Taisho will be on Feng Shui's single atom from the Book of Serenity, Case 34, Feng Shui's single atom. Introduction. Bare-handed, empty-fisted, 1,000 changes, 10,000 transformations. Though this is making something out of nothing, what can you do? You employ the provisional to symbolize the real. But tell me, is there a fundamental basis or not? Case. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up an atom, the nation perishes. Zhui Du held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? Verse. As a greyhound rising from a hunt by the Wei River, how does that compare to those who starved in purity on Mount Shuyong? It just lies in a single atom, distinguishing changing conditions. Fame and accomplishment, both are hard to efface. So, thank you all very much for coming to practice today. Really wonderful koan that probably would mystify most people who haven't done much chan, much zen. In the koan goes like this. Let me read it one more time. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. That's the heart of the koan. So if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't, the nation perishes. Now, if you don't know much about Zen, you haven't done much Zen practice, this koan won't make any sense at all. You know, we study in school about the atomic particles. So I can remember when I was in about the sixth or seventh grade, we would have science class, and the teacher would pull down a display that showed electrons revolving around the center of an atom. Planets revolving around the sun. And the center of the atom had one part of it was a sphere, and one part of it was red, and one part of it was black, and the black part was sort of like a little bump on the red sphere. And we were told those were protons and neutrons. So, we were told that everything was made up of these basic particles. And these were the smallest things in existence. So, if you hear this koan, you might be reminded of your science class, atoms. When we get a little older, we take chemistry. And we study molecules and how molecules are made up of atoms and how different combinations of atoms make different molecules. Yeah. So if you take chemistry, you have to actually be able to display the arrangement of different molecules, the atoms that make up different molecules. So, all of this might come to mind if you're listening to this koan and you might wonder, what does Zen have to do with atoms? That's not something we normally associate with Zen, right? You know, chemistry, atoms. And you might spend a long time trying to figure this out, you know. If you don't pay attention to a single atom, the nation will perish. And if you pay attention, the nation will flourish. You know, when I was growing up, they had invented the atom bomb, and every nation wanted to have lots of atom bombs. But actually, that's not what the koan is about, fortunately. You know, actually, you know, if you've done a little zazen, you might have a hint. You might have a clue about what this koan is about. If you don't, you just say, you sit on the cushion, you watch your breath, you enter samadhi, and then you just say, single atom, single atom, single atom. And you might have to sit with this koan for a long time, or you might not. When we are learning Zen, we sit down on the cushion, and we watch our breath with a straight back, and the mind is full of thoughts. You know, people who don't meditate think they have clear minds. Completely clear. You know, people will say to me, my mind is clear. And then they'll sit down and try zazen, and they get up and their faces are a little bit shocked. Because they realize their mind isn't clear and calm at all. When you sit down on the cushion and you try to watch your breath, you notice that your mind is like a buzzing beehive of thoughts. You know, and it's here a little bit, and then it's there, and then it's somewhere else, and then it's somewhere else. In the early Pali Sutras, this condition of distractedness was called the monkey mind. Monkey mind. And most people don't know they have monkey minds. In fact, very few people are aware of this. But the ordinary mind is very much like a monkey mind. And what that means is that, you know, if you ever watch monkeys, you know, or chimpanzees, let's say, you know, a chimpanzee is swinging along through the forest, and it sees a piece of fruit. So it goes down the tree and it picks up the fruit, and it starts to inspect the fruit, but then it sees another piece of fruit. So it drops the first piece of fruit and goes to the next one, and then it finds a rock that's interesting, so it throws aside that piece of fruit and it goes to the rock. So the ancient people in India and in China had seen this, right? They'd seen how easily distracted monkeys are, and they realized, you know, we're a lot like our simian cousins. You know, we think we have great powers of concentration, but when we pay attention to our mind, we realize we're just like those chimps. You know, one minute we're focused on something and it seems like life and death, and the next minute we're thinking about lunch, and the next minute we're thinking about the election and what a jerk Donald Trump is, you know, and then the next minute we're thinking about somebody we love who's in the hospital, then the next minute we think about needing to take a bath, and then we think about buying groceries. So this is a typical mind, right? This is the monkey mind. We're here, 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 and when we're learning how to meditate, it's very challenging because of the monkey mind. You know, the teacher will say, please watch your breath or focus on your breath. And again, for a beginner, that seems absolutely ridiculously easy. What could be simpler than focusing on the breath? But as soon as you start to do it, people are often overwhelmed by their monkey minds. It's so difficult to focus on the breath when you want to focus on the breath. It seems like you think of everything under the sun except the breath. And when you're learning how to meditate, the initial stages of meditation practice are so, sometimes people experience the relief of entering a thoughtless state. And they do this very quickly, But other people have to work really hard, to get to that state where you're able to watch your breath. you know, you sit down on the cushion and there's all these thoughts popping up, different thoughts, the monkey mind. And it might take you a month, maybe, before you sit, you come in, you sit down on the cushion, and then for just a little window of time, just a little period, you're able to watch your breath without interruption. It might just be 2 or 3 seconds the first time it happens. And that state of mind is actually quite a breakthrough, even though it might seem trivial and it might be very brief. You know, normally we are in monkey mind, and we have easily distracted minds. You know, it's just amazing. If you begin to watch your mind, you'll see how quickly distracted you are. And when we sit down on the cushion and we start to focus, it's such a struggle to get to the breath. You have to just keep pulling your mind back to the breath, pulling your mind back to the breath. In Zen tradition, this is symbolized. In Zen, we have something called the ox herding pictures. The ox herding pictures. And these, if you ever have a chance, you could Google ox herding pictures Zen. And you will see these wonderful pictures that were done in China to represent different stages in Zen practice. So, you know, the initial stage of Zen practice is hearing about Zen and looking for the buffalo, or the ox, you know, the water buffalo. And that's like hearing about Zen and beginning to think I might practice Zazen. So, you know, when you eventually find the ox, your job is to lead him down the road. But, you know, I don't know if you've ever, you know, we are all, here in New Jersey, we're all pretty much city folks, you know. New Yorkers think we're a bunch of hicks out here, but we're not. We're city folks. We're very sophisticated. New Jersey people are very sophisticated, actually. And, you know, we don't really have, like, chickens in our backyard or cows, you know, very rarely do I meet somebody who owns a cow. But, you know, if you do run into an ox, it's very impressive, very impressive. They are huge lumbering animals. And they're probably several times heavier than a cow. And they have big, heavy legs, right? In you know, the Chinese, especially in South China, used water buffalo, which is a kind of ox, to plow their fields, you know. And, you know, we think, oh, how cute, a water buffalo is a big brute, you know. And so, you know, the job of this, in the Zen ox herding pictures, the job of the, it's usually like a little boy, finds the ox and now has to herd the ox or pull the ox down the road. But you know, the ox is a stubborn beast, you know, so the ox starts following the little boy. Maybe the little boy's pulling on a rope and the rope is connected to a ring around the ox's nose. And the boy starts pulling the ox and it seems to be going okay, but the ox looks over and he sees some grass. And the little boy is very tiny. He doesn't really worry about the little boy, so he just stops and he leans over and gets some grass and eats some delicious green grass. So then the boy has to pull him back on the road and try to drag him away from the grass and down the road. And the ox takes a few steps and he looks over and he sees some water on the other side of the road. And he thinks, oh, I'd like a drink. So he drags the little boy back 10 steps and has some water. Well, this is your experience if you're starting to do Zen. It's frustrating, right? It's hard to focus on the breath. But, you know, if you keep practicing, if you're persistent, you know, one day, you just get it. You sit down on the cushion, and instead of having the thoughts overwhelm you, the thoughts are sort of off to one side, and the breath is at the center of your attention. If you ever have the chance to read ancient Buddhist sutras, the Pali Sutras, they talk about this. The same term we use in Zen. They call it one-pointed mind. One-pointed mind. So, you know, once you can begin to focus your attention on the breath, the thoughts begin to move to the margin and your attention is able to zero in like a beam of light on your breath. And you can begin to hold this concentration for much more than a couple of seconds. Now, it's not the case that most people can maintain that level of concentration for half an hour. That would be quite extraordinary. You would be a deeply accomplished yogin, if you could do that. And it's unlikely that after 20 years, you could do that very easily. It would be a real challenge. You know, every once in a while, you'll actually find yourself sweating on the cushion. That's the truth. You know, this is a mind-body practice. It takes your whole being. And, you know, if you're really focused, sometimes you'll sit down. People have said to me, I don't understand it. I'm actually, like, sweating. And part of that's energy. You're stimulating your energy system. But part of it's just holding the mind attentively on the moment in one point, with one pointed attention, one pointed mind. When we start doing zazen, it's a challenge because our minds are all over the place, you know. And if we continue to practice with great regularity, great faithfulness, you know, the day will come when you sit down on the cushion and you're able to achieve one-pointed attention. You know, you suddenly, there's breath, 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 and the thoughts are far over to the side. And you might think, you know, when you pause to reflect on what's happening, you might be delighted at first. You might say, I'm doing it. You know, this is it. This is the thoughtless state. You after a while, after able to enter that state for a little bit, you might take it for granted. You might think, oh, there's nothing to this. You know, it's just a thoughtless state. But actually, you know, if you learn to do this enough, you'll begin to appreciate how precious this state is, this thoughtless state. You know, normally, people are tormented by their mental lives. It's quite the case. Even people who are not disturbed or who are, you know, functional people, people who are basically sane people, are often tormented by their mental lives. This is really true. You know, and this happens to all of us, happens to me. You know, this week at work, I had some big problems to contend with, you know. And I woke up at 3:00 in the morning, and there they were, you know, just focused, you know, there they were, right at the center of my attention. They woke me up out of sleep. And it was the typical situation, you know, I said, I've got to get up at 5:00, you know, go away. Let me go back to my dreams. I think I was dreaming of water or something beautiful. And I've got to get my sleep or I'll be tired, you know. And of course, if you say that to yourself, you won't go back to sleep, you know. You create more tension, right? So then it's like, oh my gosh, it's 3:30. Oh my gosh, it's 4:00, right? You know, we all do this, right? We're tormented. Now you could say, why bother to think about this, right? Because indeed, I can't solve the problem now. It's the weekend, right? I could, you know, while we were sitting here this morning, the phone rang. Somebody has some problem, and he's calling the office at Saturday morning at like 9:00. Nobody answered the phone. Well, I could do the same thing. I could call over the office I need to talk to, and nobody's going to answer the phone. So wouldn't it be nice if you could just say to your brain, okay, nobody's going to take that call. Why don't you worry about this on Monday, right? Wouldn't that be great, you know? But alas, you know, that's not what we do. You know, we hold that anxiety and then we get into these loops, right, where you keep rehearsing. You see people waiting for a bus. You've seen this, people waiting for a bus and they keep stepping off the curb. You know, stepping off the curb isn't going to bring the bus, right? But they're rehearsing, their anxiety is making them rehearse getting on the bus. Come and step off the curb, step off the curb, step off the curb. You'll see people doing that. It's an interesting behavior, right? You're anticipating the solution and it's not yet here, but anticipating the solution when it's not yet here actually creates more anxiety, right? If you're waiting for the bus and you do a crossword puzzle, the bus will come without any emotional distress, right? But if you keep stepping off the curb, come on, it intensifies your stress. Well, we all do this, right? When we go into a difficult situation, you know, if we could just walk into, maybe we go into a room where we're going to be confronting somebody who's hostile. You know, this actually happened to me. About 20 years ago, I wrote an article about a book that I was critical of. And I thought there were a lot of problems with this book. And I won't go into the problems, but I thought they were really significant. And I was asked to review the book. So I wrote a book review, and it was by multiple authors. And I had criticisms of a number of the pieces in the book. And it was published. And one of the authors in that collection became furious at me. I was giving a paper later at a conference, and there was somebody in the audience at the end. I said, "Well, are there any questions?" He stuck up his hand and he started like attacking me. Right? This really is true. This was like 20 years ago. I got an email from him a few months ago, right? And he's still mad at me 20 years later. Really? And he has a new book out, and he wanted to challenge me to like a public debate. You know, he was going to try to arrange some kind of at some conference where he could finally get the last word, you know? And people who know him, you know, say, you know, there are people who know both of us, and, you know, he constantly goes around bad-mouthing me and things like that. It's true, you know, and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm certainly not going to, you know, sword fight him in an auditorium somewhere. And we did talk after the article came out, and I said, "Well, maybe I've misrepresented your position. Tell me about it." And he told me about it, and I said, "No, I disagree with you. I didn't misrepresent it." And that just made steam come out of his ears. So, you know, sometimes we get trapped. We get trapped by our mental processing. You know, I mean, this guy feels I did him an injustice. And, you know, the editor who read the critique, did not feel I was being unfair. She actually thought it was a very good review, and she complimented me and said, and she actually agreed with me. And I think probably maybe 50% of the people in my business would agree with me. So, you know, it should, you know, people have written bad things about my work too. You know, about 20 years ago, I opened a very journal in my field, and there was a lead article that mentioned my name. And I thought, oh, great, my old friend. She's actually a person, her name is Min Lu. She's a Chinese scholar. And I thought, oh, Min Lu, my old friend. And she was just trashing me. She mentioned my name, but then she, you know, basically criticized something I wrote. So, you know, we all, you know, if you write things, you're not going to please everybody, right? And, you know, I was a little hurt. It took me a little zazen to forget about that. And the next time I saw Min Lu, it was difficult for me to be natural with her. My impulse was to strangle her, right? But then I realized that would not be a mature thing to do. So, you know, it was hard to go over and go, "Hello, how are you?" You know, and I didn't want to say, "I enjoyed your trashing of my work, of my life's work," you know. So, you know, but you know what? A couple of years after that, she actually came up to me at a conference and apologized and said she was very sorry she had written that review. So, and she said she changed her mind. And in a recent article she published, she actually cited me in a very favorable way. You know, so, you know, it's hard for us. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just turn this stuff off, right? It would have been nice if I could have just said, well, you know, I'm going to see Min Lu and I'm going to be nice to her because what the heck? But, you know, there was like I was dragging this injured self along with me into my encounter with her, right? And, you know, after that review, you know, I had to go to a conference and, you know, lots of people had read that review and I, you know, it made me uneasy to encounter anybody, right? You know, it was like everybody in the profession agrees with her, but they didn't, you know, and they know this is, people disagree, you know, that's what we're paid to do in a way, you know. So, you know, it was, it colored the whole experience of a conference for me. And I would encounter people always like a little diffident because I was feeling attacked and I felt maybe embarrassed or humiliated, you know. If I could have just put it aside and just, you know, the thing is, a couple of years later, none of this matters, you know. It's all fine. You know, it's hard to have that kind of freedom. It's hard to have that kind of freedom. We all carry these things around with us. And there are some that we don't even, whose sources we don't even remember, right? You know, we all carry with us these things, these injuries or these experiences that we might even have mostly forgotten about. But, you know, they still color our experience. We're still sort of prisoners or tormented by them sometimes, right? You know, it would be so nice if, something happens and you could just say, I'm not going to deal with this right now, I'm just going to be in the moment, right? And usually that doesn't work, actually. You know, just commanding yourself to be in the moment doesn't work. But you can train yourself to be in the moment. And Zazen, part of Zazen is doing just that, is learning how to get to be present in the moment. And the first time you experience just being present with your breath, it may seem very trivial. But, you know, if you keep coming back to that place, that present moment with your breath, you know, you begin to change your mental processing. It's like you deepen your power of being present. You deepen your ability to be focused on the here and now. Your one-pointed mind gets stronger and stronger. This is really true. I mean, I'm certainly not a brain scientist, but you know, they do say, you know, when you do certain things repetitively, you strengthen your neural pathways. You build new neural networks. And there's no better example of this than Zazen. Because, you know, the way we process information is often a result of our mental habits, which can be very painful and destructive, pain-inducing and destructive. But, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, you're training your mind to respond to stressors in a different way. So when most people are stressed, they begin to obsess, right? They step off the curb trying to get the bus to come. And that produces these loops, right? These loops that you just incessantly re-examine the situation, trying to find a solution, but there is no solution. There is no solution. It's like, you know, when people die, you know, we try to process that using the mind, a certain kind of mind, certain kind of mental processing. You know, we want an answer. You know, why did he die? Why did she die? Why did she have to die? And we're looking with our discriminating mind for some kind of resolution. But, you know, there's no answer that's going to be acceptable. What could somebody say to you? You know, people will say, well, he's in a better place, or he's in heaven, or something like that, and it might be true and it might not, but it's really not really, I think, consoling. You know, actually, if you love someone and they're gone, knowing they're in a better place is slightly consoling, but it doesn't put them back here. It doesn't bring them back to life, right? So you know, this is typical. You know, there's another way to respond to stressors. You know, instead of going through these feedback loops and repeating, you know, when you do zazen, you're sitting down and you're focusing, you're grounding yourself in the moment. So your stressors are there, but your response is different. Instead of going into those loops where you're trying to find a solution when there's no solution, there's no sense worrying about it now, you can't do anything until Monday, you ground yourself in the present moment. You learn how to shift into like an alternate consciousness, an alternate kind of processing. And you ground yourself in the moment. And this is liberation. This is really powerful liberation. You know, you will notice that if you can really be present in the moment, your anxiety level just drops precipitously. And you will feel expansive and liberated. It's the most beautiful thing. It not just anxiety, but grief, you know, fear. You know, doing a regular zazen, returning to the present moment, grounding yourself in the moment, is this tremendous, tremendous gift, tool, instrument, strategy, whatever you want to call it. But it's really deeply liberating, you know. I have to say, it has saved me time after time after time. You know, when I first came to Rutgers, you know, Rutgers is a very competitive university. And, you know, the first thing that happened to me when I got to Rutgers was the chairman called me into his office and he said, you're a young assistant professor. Let me tell you the truth. At the end of 5 years, if you don't have a book and 6 articles, you're out of here. You know, and he was this chain-smoking old man, he terrified me. And I went back to my house and just thought, I'm doomed, right? You know, so you know, if you sit there and think, I'm doomed, you're going to be doomed, right? You know, you can't write 2 words on a page if you're so anxious about failing. Right? If you're anxious about failing, it colors everything you do. It poisons everything. You know, to be creative, to be truly alive, you have to be spontaneous. Right? You have to go. We say go with the flow. You have to trust the process. Right? And if you're thinking in 6 years an axe is going to come down and chop off my head, it's very hard to be creative. Right? So. You know, zazen really saved me because, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you just ground yourself in the moment, and then you can think a very different mode. It's a different mode of interacting with the world. You get off the cushion and you suddenly feel carefree. You know, you feel carefree, like, you know, we say devil may care. You know, it's like whatever comes, fine, you know. And that may not last for the rest of your life. Tomorrow you have to sit back down on the cushion. But you get to that place where it's like, whatever comes, comes. You know, that's fine with me. You know, bring it on. And when you're in that place, you have that spirit. You really do. And you can go through the day, and, you know, it's just like one problem after another. If you can ground yourself in the present moment, It's an incredible asset, you know. When I first got to Rutgers, another example of this was that our office handles a lot of students. You know, we handle like 13,000 students a year in our program. And when I first got to my job, the office was like a madhouse. First of all the secretaries smoked. So the place was full of smoke all the time. And my predecessor was a guy who never should have had the job. He was the most disorganized person I've ever met. When he introduced me to the job, he took me into his office and he had a big table, and on the table were all the unread and unanswered memos for the last 6 months. Seriously. And he introduced me to the job by just pulling unanswered memos off of this pile and reading it to me and explaining them to me. So he was incredibly disordered. So the place was like a madhouse, right? And, you know, it would be one crisis after another. And when I first got there, you know, one of the secretaries said to me, "You are so calm." And I actually was surprised that she said it because, you know, like everybody else, I feel like I'm always about, I don't feel calm at all a lot of the time. I feel like, you know, I'm a screaming Mimi. I'm, you know, oh my, everything's going to fall apart. You know, I feel that way too. But, you know, I think I was calm because I could ground myself in my breath. You know, there was a big crisis and I just sat down. And I was in that place. I didn't even have to try, you know. And when you get into that place, it's like you just, I'll deal with this, I'll deal with this, I'll deal with this. And you no longer feel, you're no longer in the mode of a dreadful anticipation, right? That's our, often we're in this mode of like dreadful anticipation. And nothing can be accomplished in dreadful anticipation, right? Thinking the worst is not to be creative, to be responsive, we have to have like a devil-may-care attitude, right? You have to be able to say, I'll take whatever comes, right? And how do you get that if you don't have it? You know, and I don't think very many people are born with that, you know. But we can cultivate that by practicing Zazen. So you can, when a crisis arises, if you've trained yourself well, you instinctively go to that place. You don't even have to think, uh-oh, find the calm place, right? You're there because you've done it hundreds of times. You've rewired your brain, see? I have to say, it's absolutely saved my life, you know? We all have stressors, and they're never going to stop if you try to do anything in your life. You know, my wife is on the tree commission for Plainfield. So they are a dedicated bunch of nature lovers who are on this commission for the city where I live. And their job is to oversee the purchase and planting of street trees. There's all kinds of people on there. There's some academics, there's some lawyers, there's business people. Every time my wife comes back from a meeting, she says it's an argument. It's usually not an argument among the people on the committee, but it's an argument with the committee has an argument with the city. They have planted all these new trees, and on streets that have no power lines, you can plant tall trees. But on streets that have power lines, you have to plant small trees. Or the power company has the legal right to come and saw off all these branches on the tree. So in the old days, people would plant like oak trees under these power lines. And then the power company comes and says, oh, they're in the way of our power lines, and they just destroy the tree. It looks awful. It looks like somebody's tortured the poor tree. So the tree commission, you know, they've worked very hard to put a small tree under the power lines and a big tree across on the other side. And it's working really well. Now, the federal government has changed the rules, right? So now it used to be, a tree has to be 5 feet from the wires. Now it has to be 20 feet from the wires. So, you know, the whole, they were all just tearing their hair out. But, you know, nothing in this world can be done without frustration. You know, she could quit. She could say, that's the end. But, you know, then there won't, they could all resign and say, hell with this, right? But then Plainfield's going to look worse, right? You know, they all love trees, they know trees, they spend hours picking the right trees for the right street. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful example of what humans can do when they cooperate. And the results are stunning. They've done a couple streets in town, and they've planted these new elms that are disease-resistant elms, and they're beautiful. Okay. So, you know, they've done good things, good deeds, and now it's a fight. Right, and they're frustrated and angry, But you know, nothing in this world can be done without frustration. If you're trying to avoid frustration, you will never accomplish anything. You know, even, you know, you're going to piss people off no matter what you do. There's going to be a struggle. You know, even the Buddha, they tried, the Buddha's cousin tried to assassinate him, you know. So even the Buddha, you know, had an enemy, right? The Dalai Lama has an enemy, you know. There's this split-off group of Tibetan Buddhists who are mad at the Dalai Lama, you know. It's like, if you're mad at the Dalai Lama, come on, you know. So basically, you can't please everybody. If you run away from stress, you can't accomplish anything. You can't learn, right? So having this ability to ground yourself in the moment is absolutely indispensable. You know, absolutely indispensable. I was reading the other day a psychologist whose specialty is very creative people. And he said they all have, you know, he was looking at people like Mozart, Einstein, you know, all these. And he said, you know, when you read the biographies of these people, they all have one thing in common. He said they're very serene. Isn't that interesting? He said they're very serene. You know, they Mozart's life was constantly falling apart, but, you know, he could enter this serene state. You know, and Einstein was like this too. You know, they've done studies of Einstein's likely IQ, for what it's worth, and he's not the smartest guy in the universe. Actually, he's quite smart, but you know, it wasn't just his brain power. He had the right personality to be creative, and people who knew him said, you know, he was he was serene. You know, when he would get frustrated, you know, with his physics problem, he would take out his violin and just sit and play his violin for a while. And it would calm him down and make him feel at ease, right? So you know, Zazen is another way. If we don't have that serenity, if we didn't grow up with it, maybe nobody does. Maybe some people have it. But if we don't have it, we can get it. You know, and you know, serenity is worth a lot, it turns out. You know, all of these people are very creative. They all have this ability to enter this serene state. It's like lifted out of all those stressors, right? And so very important, you know, very important to be able to do this. So, you know, the koan is pointing to something about meditation practice that we could easily take for granted. You know, just being in, you know, when you are in this moment, just this moment, you know, that's what that serenity comes from, right? If you think about yesterday, if you think about tomorrow, you're going to drive yourself crazy, right? That's where your anxiety, you say, I'm just going to be right here now, right? That's what we're doing when we're watching our breath. We're going to be just right here now. I'm not going to worry about the crisis in my office. I'm going to be right here now, because it's not happening right now, right? Just ground yourself in this moment, this single atom of time. Be here now. And if you can be here 100% or even like 80% or 75%, you're going to feel your stress drop away. And you begin to feel this deep serenity, deep serenity. And having this power can allow us to live such a more joyous and spontaneous life. And there's a deeper dimension to this as well. You know, I can't help but think, you know, no culture on earth has ever devoted so much time to planning the future, right? I mean, this is the most future-oriented society that's ever existed. You know, I don't know if you followed this, but Janet Yellen has raised interest rates by a tiny little bit. And it's sent off shockwaves. Everybody's talking about what's likely to happen. Nobody knows. You know, so all these people are writing about this in the newspapers, editorials, blah blah blah. You know, nobody knows. We plan, 10 years ahead. You know, we're constantly future directed, and we're planning. There are people who prognosticators, who are like statisticians, who try to look at present trends and say where things are going and so on. You know, and yet, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, that no society's ever been so future directed, and now when we look at the future, it looks like doom, right? It's like global warming. I was reading the other day that we're running out of topsoil. It's like we know there's global warming. We know that there'll be a water shortage because of the population and desertification. And then I opened the Huffington Post, and there was an article that said, well, that's not the only problem we have. We're also running out of topsoil. If you think those are problems, wait till we run out of topsoil. So it's like, we're so future-directed, but when you look ahead, it's in a way, it looks pretty bleak, right? The more you look ahead, the bleaker it looks, actually. So, as a culture, too, you know, we don't necessarily have a healthy mentality. If we have big problems, the way to deal with them is to try to be in this grounded mentality, this serene mentality. You know, you can't think outside the box if the box is terrifying to you, right? If you feel imprisoned by the box. So the worst thing, you know, the noisier your mind becomes, the noisier the world becomes, the more chaotic the world becomes, the quieter you have to be. And this is absolutely essential. Everybody wants to do something. And people will say, you Zen people, you just sit on your ass. And it's like, that's actually very good advice. You know, when in doubt, sit on your ass. You know, really. So important. Don't just do something, sit there. Right? Very important. When in doubt, sit on your ass and watch your breath. You know, that you're likely to make the best possible judgments in that situation. When you're driven by fear and anxiety, you're almost everything we do that is driven by fear is a bad decision. Almost 100%. Decisions made in fear are almost always the bad decision. The good decision is the decision we make in this serene, grounded place. That's when we can really hear others. That's when we can really see what's happening. And that's when we can really know what we want. We want. You know, when we're motivated by fear, we can't listen to ourselves, right? You know, you might have a job you love and somebody offers you more money doing something you don't love. But, you know, your terror of poverty or fear or insecurity may make you take that job. You just sit down on your ass for a while and watch your breath. You realize, you know, what I want to do is what I'm doing. You can't even hear yourself if you're coming from that fearful place. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the whole nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Zhuedu held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? So Zhuedu understood. He held up his staff and he said, are there any monks or nuns here who can live and die with that carefree spirit, with that trust in life? They know how to ground themselves in the moment. Verse, as a graybeard rising from a hunt by the Wei River, how does that compare to those who starved in purity on Mount Shuyang? It just lies in a single atom. distinguishing changing conditions. Fame and accomplishment both are hard to efface. So, you know, when we're thinking about results, fame and accomplishment, when we're thinking about starving, yes, we can't make good decisions. We can't be spontaneous. We can't recognize changing conditions because we're blinded by our projections. So, you know, please practice zazen. Please ground yourself in this moment.